KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m. streaming online. Racial and social justice activist Ajama Umi will deliver a keynote presentation addressed, Does American Identity Equal White Supremacy? This MLK Observance will also feature a Q&A session, songs, and readings. Again, that's the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel, Happy New Year.
Hi, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both Rachel and I are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today in Zoom is Ty Brock. Hey, Ty.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so glad you could be our guest today. So we always start out our show by just getting to know a little bit about our guest teaching background and what inspired them. So talk about your teaching background.
Yeah, so actually I started in public schools way back in 2008 as an instructional aide up in Vancouver, Washington, at an elementary school up there. And I worked there for several years. And then as I was about ready to start my MAT program through Western Oregon, I took a job at North Marion as an instructional aide as well. And then once I did my student teaching there, and once I got done and finished the program, I transitioned into a teaching role at the school. They had a job open. And then I worked as a teacher at North Marion until this past fall, as an English teacher, the activities director, running the student government and all that stuff. And then just recently I took a job as a licensed full-time sub at Jervis High School. So that's where I'm at right now.
And tell us what inspired you to become a teacher.
Well, originally after my undergrad, I was going to go into broadcasting and journalism. And I worked for a hot second at Statesman Journal. I was doing some sports broadcasting in Longview, Washington for the local radio show up there. And as I got into it and spent, you know, some time doing that, it just became obvious that it was a really lonely job. You know, late nights, you didn't really get to see the impact of what you were doing. And so thinking back through, you know, my high school English teacher that I was really close with, my college professors I was close with, friends who were teachers, they always were telling me, Ty, why don't you become a high school teacher? You'd be really good at it. And I just kind of, you know, poo-poo it, because, you know, when you're young, you're trying to go against your family. And yes, everybody in my family was teachers. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. But then it got to the point where I was like, you know what? There's something to this. If so many people are telling me that I would be good at that, then why am I, you know, not listening? And then also, you know, those were the people, the English teacher in high school, my college professors, who really helped me find my voice and find who I am and what I stand for. And so I wanted to help students find their voice, just like my teachers helped me.
Great. And how about union involvement? What sort of role have you played, or have you played a role in your union?
Yeah, I became much more heavily involved in the union around 2016-ish. And I started out as the political action committee chair, and then transitioned the last couple years. And this is when I was at North Marion, as I was the secretary on the exec board. And so I, you know, went to the RAs, I went to a lot of the OEA, you know, conferences and stuff, and I would come back and report to our local, and just became very heavily involved with it for the final 5 years that I was at North Marion.
Very cool. Well, we wanted to have you on the show because you have a very interesting story, especially in light of all of the attacks that have been leveled against educators, which are defined as, you know, critical race theory attacks sometimes, although they're not really talking about critical race theory, right? So can you just start at the beginning, maybe before the attacks started? You are a slam poetry or spoken word artist, I think. Was that accurate? Okay.
Yeah.
So talk about what slam poetry is, maybe first for our listeners who aren't familiar with that, and then how you got started in that and what that work means to you.
Yeah, so slam poetry, you know, a lot of people will pinpoint it as the beginning was in 1984 in Chicago, when they started doing these competitions for performance poetry, combining elements of your performance on the stage with the content of the poem. And then there would be judges in the crowd who would then give scores from 0 to 10 for each opponent, and there would be a couple of rounds. The audience is supposed to get involved and try to sway the judges, but the judges aren't supposed to let the audience sway them. And so, you know, it was just more of a lively atmosphere, trying to, I guess, rebuke that old white guy, stuffy poetry genre. And so, but slam poetry actually goes back before then to, you know, the Watts Prophets in the 60s, the Last Poets, Gil Scott Heron, you know, you could even go back to Langston Hughes. And so it's a way of combining those elements of performance on the stage with the actual poem itself. It's more political, it's more emotional. It's really become a very popular style of poetry now, especially with the youth. There's Brave New Voices that was on HBO for a long time. Youth Speaks is an organization that does poetry slams for high school age kids all across the country. So it's really become a big form of poetry. How I got into it, when I was in college, I was a very quiet, isolated introvert, and I had always been writing poetry and rhymes and things like that, but I was never quite confident to go up and do it. But I always watched Def Poetry Jam with on HBO, and I was really inspired. I was like, man, I can do that. And finally, my girlfriend at the time kind of inspired me to, why don't you just go try it? So I went to a poetry slam down in Eugene and competed, and happened to win. And so I was like, okay, yeah, I can do this. And so I kind of got into it. And then throughout college, I became like the editor of the literary magazine at Western Oregon. I would, you know, organize poetry jams on campus for people. And then the few years after college, I continued to get involved up in Portland. I took a little bit of a break when I was doing my MIT and, you know, got married and trying to get into the teaching profession.
Yeah.
But then my students actually several years ago in my honors English class inspired me to get back into it, you know, because I would tell them I used to do this stuff and they're like, well, what stopped you? And then I, you know, and they're like, well, that's kind of a lame excuse, you know? And so they really pushed me to get back into it. So just, you know, over the last 3 years, getting back into the Portland poetry scene has been quite invigorating. And so that's how I got into it.
So it sounds like much of your work is kept separate from your teaching, but some of it I hear you've brought into your classroom and used with your students. How have you used slam poetry in your lessons, and how do your students typically respond to it?
Yeah, so, you know, when I use slam poetry in the classroom, it's generally, you know, I'm using the slam poets who are out there. There's Button Poetry, there's Youth Speaks, the Brave New Voices. I use those as the examples to really get the kids wrapped up in it and see someone their age, you know, doing this, so they can see like, oh, this is possible. And so, you know, we talk a lot about the performance element, the craft element, all the examples, we workshop things. We really create like a little writer's community in the classrooms. And I originally did that with my honors English class, and then the kids from that class wanted it to become its own class. Mm-hmm. And so they actually were the ones who basically petitioned to have a poetry class started. So then they got that started, then we started doing it that way. And then it usually culminated in like an end of the trimester poetry jam that was open to the community and the school, and the kids would get up on stage and they would perform their poems, and there would be all these things going on in the crowd, other students. It really created this amazing community. However, you know, as a teacher, it's always good practice to model the assignments along with your students. So there, you know, a lot of times I would do my, you know, come up with some poems to go along with the assignments. And so every now and then, that's how I would incorporate my own poetry into the class. But the kids really loved it. Some kids were just like, I'm never going on stage. I'm not going to do it. They would write their poem, but they didn't want to get up there, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But they really loved it because it created like this little community, and they found out things about their classmates they never would have known before. So it was really, really inspiring.
Wow, that sounds very powerful. Well, just a little shift. North Marion is a small rural community and school district, but not so far that you can't commute from the Portland metro area. You grew up there. What was it like living there?
Well, you know, growing up there, it was great. But, you know, as you get older, you realize it's easy for me to say that given my proximity to middle-class white privilege and the fact that I've come from a family who's established in the North Marion community for a very long time. And so, of course, my experience growing up there was fantastic. But, you know, it is honestly a great place with great people that are always willing to help. It's very, you know, there's a lot of really tight-knit, close community atmosphere down there. But then, you know, as I get into teaching and I get older, I kind of became aware of the inequities that exist and the fact that the community is built on migrant farm labor. And so you have migrant farm labor families going through the school with the farming families who run those farms and employ the migrant farm labor. And so there's that dynamic there that, you know, kind of exposes the inequities.
Mm-hmm. So you ended up teaching in the community you grew up in and had relationships with people in the community. I'm wondering if you knew you were going to get some pushback for your slam poetry work at some point. Can you tell us about when it first became an issue and what the initial pushback was like?
Yeah, I guess I did know that there would be some pushback just because poetry can be uncomfortable. You know, it inspires people to come from the soul, from the gut. And sometimes it's hard to hear those things. But I guess I was perhaps a bit naive to the extent that the pushback would be carried out. And so in 2019, at the end of the school year, doing a poetry jam circle with my class, I went up to do a poem at the very end, as, you know, kind of the end of the year. All right, you guys did it. Thanks for your bravery. Now I'll, you know, do one of mine because you know that I do this. And there was a lot of things going on at the time with some toxic masculinity, locker room talk things. I'm also a baseball coach. So I was privy to a lot of those conversations and dealing with a lot of that stuff. And so I had a poem that addresses that. It admittedly is very graphic because it's actually quoting the things that are said in those locker rooms. But ultimately it's about, you know, standing up to it, right? And it doesn't make you less of a man in those situations to stand up to it, right? Well, unbeknownst to me, someone in the class had recorded, audio recorded part of it, and then sent it directly to a local news station. And that local news station ran with it. And the way that it was portrayed made it seem like I was doing something sexually inappropriate with my class. And so I spent the entire summer of 2019 under investigation, got the help from my union, went through the whole process. They did the investigation, found that it in fact was not sexually inappropriate and that it had a message behind it that, you know, and I apologized to the use of the language, and there was a little bit of, you know, poor judgment on my part with that and not being open about what I was specifically going to read that day with my administration. So we talked it out. We made those adjustments. I made the adjustments. And for the rest of that year until the pandemic hit, you know, I was working with my admin, you know, all the time, letting them know, here's what's going on. And so that's what came out of it.
And can you just tell us a little bit more about who was attacking you and how they were going about it?
Yeah, so, you know, that 2019 incident, like I said, it got resolved. But then all of a sudden, at the start of this school year, we're back in person, and go to the first week of school, and seemingly to me, everything is going great. And all of a sudden, over that first weekend, I started getting text messages from teachers at the school, from my, you know, friends from the community, and they're sending me screenshots of social media, Facebook, the city of Hubbard, which is one of the towns that feeds into the North Marion School District, having this big explosion of comments and posts about me and my poetry. That's my professional poetry that is separate from my classroom. Things I've never brought into the classroom before. The videos that I have on YouTube, performances from my, you know, poetry slams that I've been in. And they started to attack me based on critical race theory, and saying that obviously since I did the thing 2 years ago, he's definitely still reading these poems to his kids. And now he's trying to indoctrinate them with critical race theory, and he's being racist to white people. And so it kind of started off that way. They posted the links to my videos. But, you know, that first day that I became aware of it, I had a phone call conversation with the superintendent, and she was like, hey, listen, they're bringing back up the thing from 2 years ago. There's nothing, you know, that's solved, resolved. You can't get in trouble for that. We're not going to get involved with what you do on your personal time. I wanted her to make some sort of statement about, you know, don't allow people to harass teachers on social media, but she didn't want to throw gasoline on the fire is what she said. And, you know, at that point I was kind of like, fine, whatever. But then as that night rolled along and into the week, it really just steamrolled. Like I did not see all of this coming. They began to, this small group of people began to organize on other Facebook groups I believe one of them is called Oregon Parents' Rights in Education. And this is one that I'm sure you have talked about this person before, Jeanette Sade, is involved with, who was running for school board in Beaverton and got involved in that mess with the Beaverton educators last year with critical race theory. And she was actually commenting on me. And so they were trying to organize and essentially get me fired. They posted my personal information, address, things like that, to those groups. And it just took on a whole new life of its own. And so at that point, you know, I've got a 3-month-old at home and my wife isn't working right now. And so we're thinking, holy cow, we're now being threatened. Our personal safety is being threatened. So my union rep at the building tried to get the superintendent to make a more, you know, vocal statement, and they just wouldn't do it. And it continued. You know, that whole week I went to school, every day was something new they were coming after me for. Whether it was with critical race theory or not, they started their own Facebook group to try and, you know, organize to get me out. They were talking about school board campaigns, running for school board position that was open, with the headline being, let's get Ty Brock out of there. And so I just got to the point where I was having panic attacks every day at work, anxiety when I got home, because, you know, I'm worried about, is somebody going to show up, you know, outside at my doorstep. Mm-hmm. And so I then took a leave, a medical leave, and didn't go back. So luckily I was able to find the job at another school district, and that's been incredible because it obviously got me away from things. So but yeah, it was definitely a dangerous, scary time.
Yeah. Has that calmed down since you left?
It did. It has. Yeah. It was kind of like, almost like they were like, okay, we got him to leave. Mm-hmm. That's what we wanted to do, which, you know, a lot of people were like, you're letting them win. But I, you know, it was hard for me because I did kind of see it that way. But, you know, been going to therapy, and my therapist told me, this is, you know, the best thing that I could pass on to other people. The greatest act of revolution against toxic and oppressive systems is not constantly banging your head against their closed door, but to choose radical self-care, and in doing so, find the open door to where you can do the work as unapologetically you.
Absolutely. Right on.
Yeah.
And when she said that to me, I was like, all right, they didn't win, I won.
Yeah.
I chose that route. So, yeah, that, but it, you know, it's a microcosm, right, of all this stuff that's going on nationally with the critical race theory, that entire so-called argument.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many other teachers are going through this and probably have it a lot worse than I did. You know, weren't able to find a new job that where they could be safe and at a district that actually is doing things with bias trainings and having a social justice class that they offer for kids and things like that. So it's definitely an issue that's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Ty, can you just you've mentioned I think your union, but can you just maybe call out some of the either individuals or groups or where you found some support during this time?
Yeah, for sure. My principal at the building was very supportive, but unfortunately with the way the power structure is set up there, she could only do so much. The teachers union, the local union, was fantastic. They were doing little demonstrations and things and you know, put together with the Oregon Educators United, you know, a change.org petition that got sent out to people. There were students, tons of students, and this was in the 2019 incident and then in this one, who were coming hard on Facebook back at these people. Like, you have no idea what really goes on in his classes you know, just being amazing like students are. And then a lot of parents too, because the thing is it's unfortunate that the district is allowing that loud minority to become the dominant voice in making decisions. And the majority of people down there, like, you know, we've discussed, that's where I come from. They know me. We might have our, you know, differing opinions on the way the world works, but they know that what I do for kids is good. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's just this very loud minority, and they're being allowed to just take over. And the rest of the community is kind of tired of it. So they just sort of back away and they're like, we don't want to get into that with them. So, yeah. But I got lots of support.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, since we don't have very much time, we definitely would love to hear some of your poetry, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us.
Sure. And I'll just perform the poem that has to do specifically with the critical race theory issue. This is called Indoctrination. Indoctrination? 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 Is this really about defending education? Or is this about indoctrination shouted so uncritically about something so critical to humanity? About indoctrination shouted with a remedy that uncritically protects thought disguised as patriotism, thought that adopts whiteness into victimhood while criticizing the critical for playing the victim. That irony doesn't hit with those shouting indoctrination, so perhaps it's best to just hit with reality that indoctrination is happening in our schools. See, it happens every day. White teacher lacks resources, training, support staff for ELLs. White teacher entrusts white student to pull ELL into hallway for daily reading practice. ELL reads in two languages but does and respects what white teacher wants. White student reads to ELL with that first taste of savior pride, that savior pride passed on in stories of his great grandpa helping braceros find a better life. ELL slumps in his chair and listens with that first sting of generational trauma, like his back is being crunched into his bisabuelo C-shaped back, toiling in 14-hour days with the short-handled hoe, tilling the land into profit for the white student's great-grandpa. White student continues reading, withholding dignity like his great-grandpa withheld wages. ELL listens to English rolling off white student's self-satisfying tongue in training, rebellion igniting like his bisabuelo rebelling against white student's great-grandpa's self-satisfying tongue-breaking promises, resulting in his bisabuelo's forced removal from the program, starting four generations of the back and forth, a family with two countries and no home, never receiving what they are owed. The bell rings. White teacher smiles at ELL. Praises white student with words, recess begins. White student goes with white friends, ELL goes with ELLs. White student laughs as white friend asks if ELL smells. ELL knows that laughter is toxic like fumigation sprayed into his bisabuelo's face upon arrival at white student's great grandpa's farm. ELL marches across the playground like his bisabuelo marched across the farm, arms tensed in defiance of the bracero program's attempts to take theirs. A left, right, fueled by four generations of racism flies into the white student's face. White students' parents want justice for their son's busted up nose. ELL meets SRO for the first time as a fourth grader. White student gets student of the month. ELL gets suspension. White student starts path to graduation with honors to college to take over the family farm to oversee migrant farm labor with the belief that they are ungrateful and possibly violent. ELL starts path to expulsion to know there is no justice here. Like his bisabuelo expelled from the farm, the program, America, Mexico, over and over. All this because white teacher lacks resources, training, support staff, because admin placated school board, placated white supremacist lawmakers, to white feelings, to persuade white rage, to protect white power. So this shouting of indoctrination isn't really about defending education. It's about defending indoctrination the way it's always been indoctrinated, which is why we pledge to know that history, to lead with bravery, to counsel, to love, to teach, to build new systems critical of the uncritical, so the white student grows up to repay and repair rather than repeat, so the student of color can thrive without fear on their land. We pledge because it's critical to end this indoctrination. Thank you.
Woo. Yeah, thank you so much. Well, we have 1 minute left. What have you learned or gained from this whole experience that you would like to pass on maybe to people in smaller rural districts?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, make sure you've got open communication going between you and your admin and with the parents. And one thing that I always did is give them the choice. You know, if the kids or the parents are going to be uncomfortable with what it is that you're teaching, no matter how right you think it is, give them that choice, because it'll save you a lot of headaches. But also, just, you know, like I said, my advice from the therapist earlier, you can't keep banging your head against a closed door. If you're someplace where you're unhappy and you're trying to do what's right, you're standing up for the right things, for equity, for social justice, and it's just not happening, it's okay to find something else. You know, there is something else out there, and somewhere where you can be you. So go for it.
Well, thank you so much, Ty, for sharing your experience with us and joining us on KBOO.
Thanks, Ty.
Thank you for having me. This was very beneficial for my mental health.
And thank you to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Last month, Safety and Justice Oregon interviewed two candidates for district attorney positions in Marion and Washington counties. They also presented their 8 Steps to Justice, a guide for progressive district attorneys.
And my name is Julianne Jackson, and I'm the movement building director for Safety.